Radio. Coming up is the news. We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Economic Guide.
He was just a school teacher, but he was elected by Peruvians in a closely contested election. But then he got overthrown in a coup, and his former VP took over. So what happened? Why are there reports of U.S. complicity? Mineral-rich Peru, like copper and gold, the subject of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, we're going to take a look at Pedro Castillo's presidency. First, he came to power to restore Peru's economy. That's what he got elected for, to favor the poor and the working class. But then what happened? Oligarchs
in parliament against the IRGC. And staying with this story, Iran once again condemns as irresponsible the European Parliament's call for blacklisting the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The foreign ministry spokesman says any imposition of sanctions against the IRGC violates the United Nations Charter. Nasser Kanani says the force is a major anti-terror organization and has played a pivotal role in bringing peace and stability to the region and beyond. Kanani is stressing that Tehran has given the necessary warnings to the EU against acting on the European Parliament's resolution. He says Iran will take countermeasures in case of any miscalculated move against the IRGC by the bloc. On Thursday, European lawmakers voted to blacklist the force as a terror group. Russia says no new date has been set for talks with the US within the framework of the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty known as START, as tensions remain high over the war in Ukraine. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says conditions are not right for new talks on the treaty. He is blaming escalation in rhetoric and actions against Moscow by Washington. The two sides were scheduled to hold talks on resuming inspections under the new START in November, but Russia pulled out, saying it had no other choice. The treaty took effect in 2011. It caps the number of strategic nuclear weapons the United States and Russia can deploy. It's time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in a little bit more detail. The European Council has called on EU leaders to speed up talks on use of confiscated Russian assets for the reconstruction of Ukraine. President Charles Michel says the profits from the frozen assets could be used for reconstruction efforts. Michel described the proposal as a question of justice. The EU has blocked 300 billion euros of assets belonging to the Russian Central Bank back in November. The move is part of the sanctions the bloc imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Moscow has hit back with its own measures, including limitations to the supply of energy to Europe. Joining us on this edition of the program is Harley Schlanger, a spokesman for the LaRouche organization from Potsdam, Germany. And we also have Greg Simons, a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Sweden. Gentlemen, welcome. And Harley, if I could start with you, does the EU have the right to use these frozen Russian assets for the reconstruction of Ukraine?
This is an act of ultimate hypocrisy. The so-called rules-based order is stealing money. That's what this sanction policy represents. They've stolen the assets that Russia deposited in Western banks, and now they're saying they're going to use it for reconstruction of Ukraine. What they should do is stop sending weapons to Ukraine and let negotiations take place. But this idea that somehow they're going to starve Russia, they're going to force Russia to go to leave Ukraine and leave the special military operation unfulfilled, it's not going to happen. So what NATO and the European Union are doing is trying to extend the war as a way of weakening and defeating Russia.
Right. So, Greg, we hear from Russian officials that Western weapons, as Harley was alluding to, are being shipped to the war zone, are only prolonging the conflicts, prolonging the suffering, prolonging the destruction of Ukraine. Does the responsibility for Ukraine's construction rest with Moscow when taking into account the dismissal of the United States as well as NATO of Russia's security guarantees, the failure of the Minsk agreements, essentially all these that triggered the war in the first place?
Well, I mean, absolutely, as you say, I mean, the responsibility doesn't solely rely on Moscow. And as has been stated, I mean, what they're proposing to do, I mean, violates these slogans which the EU goes on about the respect of rule of law and such things as property rights. So if we go into it more, I mean, as you say, I mean, they're responsible for prolonging this war, and I would, I mean, as numerous commentators have said, provoking the war. I mean, this is not one-sided, and I mean, in spite of all of their fine talk, their hands are far from being clean in this respect.
Right, so then, Harley, if the EU does use Russian funds for the reconstruction of Ukraine, doesn't that mean countries, for example, like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and so on, have the right to use American funds for the construction of their countries following the wars that America waged against them?
Well, if there were justice in the world and if the West was really committed, as they say, to sovereignty and democracy, then of course they'd reconstruct these countries. But they're not going to, because the Western war policy is built into a financial system which is collapsing. And what I would argue is that the effort to punish Russia by stealing the money, as they did with Afghanistan. Remember, they took $9 billion from Afghanistan. That by doing that, they're forcing countries to reconsider whether they want to remain in the dollar system. And we're seeing cracks in the dollar system all over the place. The Saudis now accepting the yuan for oil payments, Russian-Indian agreements, moves with the BRICS plus countries to look for a new financial system, new transaction system, new trade system. We're seeing a breakdown of the whole Western system. And what they don't realize is that by insisting on their right to take this money, they're sending messages to other countries, you can't trust the West. Now you add to that what you brought up before, the lies in Minsk that Merkel and Hollande admitted they never intended to achieve a peace agreement. Why should any country in the global south trust one of the so-called advanced sector countries now? And this is part of the breakdown of the unipolar order that's enforced by NATO arms and especially U.S. military.
Okay, and then, Greg, just a similar question. What's your take on that? I mean, can countries that were invaded by NATO and as well as the United States, who saw their cities, entire cities, carpet bombed, and villages and towns and so on damaged, can they not request or ask the US, or do they not have the right to get funding from the United States to reconstruct their energy, their infrastructure?
Well, by violating their own system of international law, they open this up. I mean, look what happened with Kosovo when it was a so-called exception that broke the rule. And, I mean, they have another moral dimension which they need to. I mean, there is the old joke. I mean, why are the pyramids in Egypt? Because they're too heavy for the British to carry away. I mean, you've got this attitude that they can just take everything because they have a strong military, a strong economy to do this, which they no longer do have. So, I mean, this is merely perpetuating and, I would say, it will accelerate the decline of the West.
Okay, on that point, gentlemen, let me thank you for your contribution. Harley Schlanger is the spokesman for the LaRouche organization, joining us from Potsdam, Germany. And Greg Simons, a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Uppsala, Sweden. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review. Right, moving on. Brazil and Argentina are planning for greater economic integration, including a common currency, which would wean off reliance on the US dollar in bilateral transactions. Brazil's President Lula da Silva and his Argentine counterpart, Alberto Fernandez, made the revelation in a joint article they penned. The text says Brasilia and Buenos Aires want to eliminate barriers to their exchanges and encourage the use of local currencies. The two countries have also decided to speed up discussions on a common South American currency aimed at boosting regional trade. Lula had brought up the idea of a common currency during his presidential campaign. He has chosen Argentina for his first trip abroad since he took office. Relations between Brasilia and Buenos Aires were tense during Brazil's former far-right President Jair Bolsonaro. And staying in Brazil, the new president has accused his predecessor Jair Bolsonaro of committing genocide against the indigenous people of the Amazon region amid public outrage of a humanitarian catastrophe there. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says Bolsonaro's far-right administration is responsible for the crisis. Lula says the previous administration encouraged the 20,000 illegal miners who flooded the region during his term and caused death and destruction. The president says Bolsonaro just abandoned the Yanomami people. Now, Lula made the remarks after a visit to the Amazon, and reports say children in the region are dying of malnutrition and diseases caused by poisoning due to gold mining. Bolsonaro denies responsibility despite criticism of his environmental policies that led to a 60% rise in Amazon deforestation. A man who went on a shooting rampage and killed 10 people during the Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations in the U.S. state of California has been found dead. Police say they found the body of the shooter after hours of manhunt. They say the suspect, identified as 72-year-old Hu Can Tran, died of a self-inflicted wound. Now, his body was inside a van in a city about 35 kilometers away from the site of the shooting in Monterey Park, which is home to a large Asian community. The investigation is still underway to determine the motive behind the carnage. The incident, which also injured 10 people, is the latest in the grim litany of mass shootings in the U.S. Over the past years, there have been growing calls for passing stricter legislation on gun control and curtailing access to weapons in the country. In the United States, Joe Biden has now reached 2 years in office, and his approval ratings has never been lower. The first part of his term has been defined by constant crises, and many speculate he won't be able to run for re-election. Rami Mazahari has more from Chicago.
United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term. And perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns. Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured. Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Economic Divide.
He was just a school teacher, but he was elected by Peruvians in a closely contested election. But then he got overthrown in a coup, and his former VP took over. So what happened? And why are there reports of U.S. complicity? Mineral-rich Peru, like copper and gold, the subject of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, we're going to take a look at Pedro Castillo's presidency. First, he came to power to restore Peru's economy. That's what he got elected for, to favor the poor and the working class. But then what happened? Oligarchs and rich were angered, including congressmen. We're going to take a look at why that made them angry. Next, taking a look at the coup itself, there was a quick VP succession to presidents. How did that happen? Some are speculating and deducting there was U.S. interference. The U.S. ambassador was a former CIA agent. Just take a look at that fact. We're going to break that open for you. Next up, overall, Latin American pink tide has taken place. You have leftist governments that have come into power, and they are anti-U.S. and anti-Western financial system. And the U.S., of course, is angered by the rise of the leftist presidents.
Peru has been going through a tough time. In December 2021, President Pedro Castillo was elected as the country's president. Castillo is a 53-year-old former schoolteacher from a humble rural background and was elected on a wave of frustration with conventional politics. Castillo replaced more than half of the ministries with new people in a bid to reshuffle the country's economic and political structure. But that apparently turned the ruling establishment against him. In an apparent bid to reform the country, he announced that he was dissolving the opposition-dominated Congress, installing a curfew, and would rule by decree. But Castillo was impeached for his moral incapacity to exercise power after a litany of crises, including 6 investigations against him, 5 cabinet reshuffles, and large protests. Castillo became the 3rd president since 2018 to be sacked under the moral incapacity provision in the Constitution. He was replaced by Dina Boluarte. Her presidency comes during a period of political turmoil in Peru that began in 2017, as she is the 6th president in 5 years. It was reported that the U.S. may have had a hand in the coup. The U.S. ambassador in Peru, a veteran CIA agent named Lisa Kenna, met with the country's defense minister just one day before the coup.
Time now to take a look at social media posts. The new year 2023 started out with protests because people are still angry about the fact that their democratically elected president, Pedro Castillo, was ousted. So we took a look and tried to pick the social media posts that reflected that and, of course, a worldview on this as reactions were posted on social media posts. Our first post said another undemocratic Latin American coup supported by the European Union. All for what? Just to facilitate Western business interests at great expense to the people of Peru. Next, don't sell EU support for Latin American coups short. EU support also clearly demonstrates subservience and fealty to the U.S. Next up, Lima's Plaza Manco Capac, where hundreds of people have camped out in protest against a parliamentary dictatorship, coup, and repression in Peru, which is filled with art and music. Next, Peru's U.S.-backed coup regime appears to be setting the stage to hand unelected presidential power to right-wing congressman Jose Williams, the former top military commander. He has been linked to drug cartels and covered up a military massacre of civilians. Gosh, I was surprised by some of these picks that our research department picked, but that does show in terms of the interference by the U.S. in one sense, and of course the way that the oligarchs and the elites were angered by Pedro Castillo's election. Let's find out what our guests think. That's more important to get an analysis on that. First up, we have Rafael Padula. He's a graduate professor in international political economy of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, Institute of Economics, who joins us. All right, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what has occurred when we take a look at Pedro Castillo, Rafael Padula, he was a school teacher from what we understand, and he was promised to restructure Peru's economy, to favor the poor and the working class. That's why he got elected. But it seems like the oligarchs, even congressmen, the rich congressmen, I must say, they were angry about this election, especially, well, Castillo replaced more than half of the ministries with new people, which is why they turned against him. Is that how this happened? Is that the case?
Oh, I think that Peruvian oligarchs, Peruvian elites, they like to control the government, they like to control the president. So we can remember about Rolando Humala, a radical left president. They couldn't change the neoliberal policies because he was really, really controlled by these elites. And it was really surprising that Rolando Humala could end his mandate. So with Castillo, it's the same thing. Castillo has a lot of proposes that he was against these elites' interests, like ending neoliberal policies, like nationalize natural resources, including the Camisea gas fields. So Pedro Castillo was really, really contrary to these elites' interests. So they couldn't control Pedro Castillo. So for these oligarchs, for these Peruvian elites, it was better to take him off the power, to end his presidency with a coup.
All right, thank you for that. Let's find out what Bruno Beclini thinks. He joins us. Bruno Beclini is an academic and political commentator. Bruno Beclini, welcome to Economic Divide. What happened to Peru? It was a political upheaval, and really it happened so quickly. when you think about it in terms of the coup. I mean, at this point, it was so quick that the people have wondered why this happened at warp speed. And one of the things that has been assessed is that the U.S. may have had a hand in the coup, mainly because the U.S. ambassador in Peru is a veteran CIA agent by the name of Lisa Kenna. For example, she met the country's defense minister just one day before the coup happened. Do you think that the U.S. has a hand in this coup, which obviously it has a long history of having hands in color revolutions and coups in general, especially in Latin America?
We must understand that the bread and butter of U.S. is to have links, ties from their diplomatics, personal, their diplomacy and intelligence network to the top-level hierarchy of Latin American states. So it is almost impossible and unbelievable to affirm that any coup d'etat in Latin America is not at least, well, very well informed and try to have links to the U.S. personnel operating in the country. This ambassador in Peru is not the only one who is operating there. I insist, Keiko Fujimori's husband is a gringo, is a U.S. citizen who has lots of accusations of money laundering. So we can't understand any coup d'etat in Latin America without looking with very, I would say, very objective point of view to the U.S. movements inside each one of our countries.
It's time now for the Info News section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at oil supplies in the world and how that stands. Obviously, it's something that's important in terms of the markets. Well, Western sanctions are actually reshaping the global energy markets. Russian oil is being rerouted to places like Asia, Africa, and Latin America, while countries in West Asia, or suppliers in West Asia, are boosting sales, meanwhile, to the EU. So you can see the shift there. Now, Middle Eastern energy exporters, or exporters in West Asia, have shifted from the traditional markets in Asia and are, at this point, based on what they are saying, they're reaping the benefits from the skyrocketing fossil fuel prices in Europe. So Europe is paying the price for this. Now, talk about Europe. Let's take a look at the Eurozone and where it stands when it comes to its economies. Well, the Eurozone economy is forecast to shrink. The region is headed for a severe recession. That's what's forecasted. There are indications that prices will rise by over 6%, which they have already. We're in almost approaching the end of January, and the unemployment rate will increase from the current 7.1%, which it's standing now. It will increase to 7.1% as the new year progresses. Now, this is a particular topic that we have a lot of focus on and interest on, I should say, and this regards poverty, and it's on East Africa. Now, Oxfam came out with this, which is combined with famine there, and it calls it the cause of neglect. It says that 500,000 people across East Africa are on the brink of famine. Of course, famine and poverty actually do go hand in hand. The number of people facing extreme hunger in Ethiopia, in Kenya, and in Somalia has more than doubled since the year before, from over 10 million to now 23 million as of today. Now, nearly 500,000 are already facing starvation based on what we have found out. As a matter of fact, this is so important to us that we're going to take a look at the next half of this report, which focuses on East Africa, and this one, again, on famine. One person on average is dying every 48 seconds from acute hunger in East Africa. 5.7 million children are acutely malnourished, and this was for the year 2022. 350,000 Somali children, for example, will die by the summer of this year if action is not taken immediately. Okay, I have to take just a second to catch my breath because those are really shocking numbers, and that needs to be dealt with. Now, this next piece of news is somewhat of a promising piece for Afghan and the Afghan government headed by the Taliban. The Taliban has actually signed an oil deal with Chinese firm. It is the first major international energy contract for the country. That's a positive sign, don't you think? It's a 25-year oil extraction agreement. Note, extraction. Got to underline that word. China's company, CAPEIC, KPIC, will be drilling for oil. So they're going to be drilling for the oil. Shows how much natural resources Afghanistan does have. And the Chinese investment for doing that is up to $150 million a year. It's not bad. That's going to increase now in increments to $540 million in 3 years' time. And in terms of jobs, 3,000 jobs will be given to Afghans. So that's a positive piece of news for that country. Really, it needs more news like that.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section of the program. In this segment, we're going to focus on structural discrimination in Peru and how it relates to the indigenous population and its relation to Peru's natural resources. That's our focus, the natural resources, which are located mainly in the south. First up, for decades, the rich and the elites in Peru, they have tried to marginalize the indigenous population from their rights to mines, again, concentrated in the south of the country. The indigenous peoples of Peru comprise about 24% of the population. We're looking at around 5,500,000 Peruvians. That's quite a bit, don't you think? Next up, Castillo. When he came to power, he fought hard to get the rights of the indigenous population when it came to their share of mining projects. Now, Peru's mining industry is essential to the country's economic development. It accounts for nearly 10% of the country's GDP. That's a lot. Mineral export revenues, they reached $27.2 billion for the year 2021, and that represented 60% of the country's total exports. Now, keep in mind this fact. Peru is the world's second largest producer of copper. Silver and zinc are also at the top of the list, but most importantly, it's Latin America's largest producer of gold. That's right. You didn't know that about Peru, did you? Next, we'll take a look at Peru's operating mines. There are 200 of them, and several large projects are ready for development. Now, back in March of 2022, direct employment in the mining sector in that country came to a little over 273,000 workers, exceeding 2021 by 4.5%. Now, Peru, in terms of the projects that it has, the main ones, there are 43 of them, and they're in different stages of development, targeting a variety of metals and minerals, representing a total investment of more than $53 billion, as you're about to see, okay? So that's the figure that we're looking at. Copper projects, they represent 69%, about $36.5 billion. Gold, 15%. And then iron ore, which comes in at 11%. So that gives you an idea about the percentage and share of the exports that we're looking at of the extraction that's happening. Next, UK, in terms of now the foreign mining investment, the UK is Peru's largest foreign investor. It is followed by China, Canada, then the United States, and then Mexico. Now, 11 countries have project portfolio investments in the mining sector. Up next, we will look at Castillo and what he actually realized was important to reform. He proposed what was called a new approach for mining companies to end the social gaps and to avoid conflicts in this sector. And that's pretty important because that kept the country from progressing in that sector, as was mentioned by Castillo. Now, Castillo's government has said, in terms of his direct quote, although the responsibility for closing gaps falls on the state, it is necessary to involve and to commit mining companies to greater social investment. That's something that was missing from mainly the indigenous population. Now, this may have angered the mining companies and the oligarchs who had control over the lucrative contracts. Okay, so there you have it. That's our quick look somewhat at the mining sector vis-a-vis the indigenous. Let's find out what our guests think. Rafael Padula, who's a graduate professor in international political economy of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, rejoins us. Rafael, welcome back. We want to take a look in this question at the way that you have a new group of left-wing presidents, as you're well aware, to have taken over in Latin America, not so much leaning towards the West economic and financial models. And one particular good example would be Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, who even has said he wants to move away from the dollar. How much do you think that Castillo fits into that mold of moving away from the Western financial system, bothering countries like the U.S.?
Oh, President Lula has been talking about to strengthen the regional integration in South America, the BRICS, and the relations with countries from the South, from the Global South. And in this way, in this sense, he has been talking about to run out of dollar as much as possible, making commerce and finance relations out of dollar with some kind of arrangement with local money, with local national money, or some kind of swaps out of dollar, because it's really, really, really visible now how much U.S. Enjoy not only the power of the dollar, the power of have the international money, but also that USA uses sanctions to punish governments which are not aligned with USA, excluding them from the international financial system, like USA did with Venezuela, with Iran, and now with Russia.
All right, very well. Let's find out what Bruno Biclini thinks. He is an academic and political commentator who rejoins us. Bruno Biclini, welcome back. I want to ask the same question that I asked Rafael Padula about the fact that you have these left-wing presidents that have come into power. Obviously, Castillo fits into that mold, and they basically have taken over Latin America because they just weren't reaping the benefits of the Western financial system. So they're trying to lean away from that. Perfect example, obviously, would be Lula da Silva. In the case of him, he has said that he wants to move away from the dollar. And this is something that is not favoring or going too well when it comes to countries like the U.S. Do you think this is bothering the U.S.?
Yeah, for sure. And there is a campaign, a dirty campaign, inside the hegemonic media corporations of all Latin America, insisting that Brazil must leave the BRICS, must leave the BRICS bloc, which is something unbelievable, which is an absurd, because all of the world understands that the U.S. dollar as the world currency, it's a form of being blackmailed by the U.S. and having being target of being sanctioned by them, just like what they did with Iran and what they are doing with Russia. It's a kind of financial dictatorship when the U.S. says that someone must be inside the SWIFT or outside the SWIFT. We must be as away as possible from the U.S. dollar as an international currency, develops and increase the sound of bank, Banco del Sur, and be a important part of the new developed bank, which is the Bank of the BRICS. Outside of this is the projection of the World Bank and the International and the IMF, saying that the world will not grow more than 3% of this next year, and we'll have a recession. If it towers our economy to the Asian network and the Asian development, we can move as far as possible from the U.S. currency and far as possible from the blackmail coming from the financial dictatorship ruled by Washington and London.
Power struggle in the country has continued as thousands of small farms struggle to survive the worst drought in half a century. Without rain, farmers cannot plant potatoes, and the dying grass can no longer sustain herds of sheep. Many Castillo supporters are poor indigenous Peruvians. They say that President Boluarte must resign, snap elections need to be held, and that the former president needs to be released. the world's number two copper producer, global economic pressures like inflation prompted by the pandemic.
Los cerros del campo es todo seco. Tenemos manantiales. Esos manantiales también se están secando. Necesitamos.
Hace que las alpacas aborten, causa mortalidad de animales adultos, causa baja fertilidad. Es decir, es el problema más grave de la ganadería alpaquera.
Have also hit Latin America hard. Peru's oil production has also declined sharply since the 1990s. This is despite Peru's considerable petroleum potential. The country is said to have 422 million barrels of proven and probable reserves, along with 14 billion barrels of oil resources. During November 2022, Peru pumped an average of 37,875 barrels per day, which was flat compared to a year earlier. Furthermore, the outlook for Peru's embattled hydrocarbon sector is bleak, despite the Andean country's considerable petroleum potential. There's also a long history of industry operations in the Amazon, causing environmental degradation, further accelerating the deterioration of the country's social problems. The latest developments in Peru's long-running political crisis will roil the country's post-pandemic economic recovery, which has been struggling to maintain momentum since 2021.
When it comes to the coup in Peru, one thing has become very clear, and that is the role of the U.S. intervention, which may have played a hand in Pedro Castillo's overthrow. First, the scenario that unfolded. The U.S. ambassador in Peru, a veteran CIA agent named Lisa Kinna, met with the country's defense minister just one day before the democratically elected president, Pedro Castillo, was ousted in a coup. Lisa Kinna's bio reads, from the U.S. regime change playbook, as an accessory to the coup, she worked for the CIA for 9 years, as well as the Pentagon. After Lisa Kinna met with Peru's defense minister, he ordered the military to turn against Castillo. Also noteworthy was that Lisa Kinna met with Dina Boluarte and reiterated Washington's wholehearted support for her. The coup set off mass protests all across Peru. The unelected government unleashed brutal violence and police killed numerous demonstrators. The coup in Peru has also set off anger from other South American countries, channeled against the U.S., which they slammed for interference in another country's affairs. These Latin America countries have criticized or even refused to recognize Peru's coup, which included Mexico, Argentina, Bolivia, Colombia, Honduras, Venezuela, Cuba, and various Caribbean nations. The CIA has organized many coups against democratically elected left-wing leaders in Latin America, from Guatemala's president Jacobo Arbenz in 1954 to Chile's president Salvador Allende in 1973 to numerous attempts for a regime change against the late Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez. That does it for this section.
And in conclusion, what has happened to Peru? It's a classic case where the status quo set by the rich and also by the oligarchs was threatened by a new entry in the form of Pedro Castillo, a school teacher of which he wanted to fight for the poor and make sure that they got their end of what society had to offer. However, that obviously made the oligarchs and the rich very angry. Now, you add to that U.S. interference, which is something that is now well known, well, there you have it. You have a coup that's happened that goes against the people that the Peruvians elected. For what other reasons could there be for an overthrow of Castillo? But this story is not over, as the recent protests demonstrate that ordinary Peruvians will not give up on Castillo. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thank you so much for tuning in. From Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program For Humanity. We were looking at the human traits in the Quran, and specifically the ones that harm other people. Why? Because obviously it goes against the concept of human rights, which we're trying to discuss. We looked at one of the concepts that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala highlighted in the Quran, that me and you as believers have to be wary, and we have to be aware of, and that is a concept of jealousy or hasad in the Quran. Now, when it comes to hasad, people say, well, how does that harm humanity? How does that harm other people? So we won't go into the introduction of this topic because we've done that in the previous episode. You can listen to it at your own time. First, if we look at the creation from the beginning, one of the reasons that me and you are on this planet and in this messy world that we in is actually caused by hasad itself. So let me take you back a trip in history, or through time, if you might say. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala first created Adam and Hawa, or Adam and Eve. And he said to the Malaika, prostrate to Adam. Now the Malaika, obviously, they had their argument and their reasons, but then they submitted. One of them, which wasn't even a Malik, was a jinn, Iblis said, why should I? If you look at him, he's mud and I am fire. You want me to prostrate to this guy? Are you serious? Allah said, yeah, I'm very quite serious. But he said, no. So his jealousy of Adam, his jealousy of the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, led him to disbelieve in Allah. And then he came to Adam and he waswasa lahu. He started whispering to Adam alayhi salam. When Adam listened to the whispers of shaitan, then this whole thing started. This whole earth and what have you started. So shaitan was a cause, or at least one of the causes, to this whole mess that human beings are in. And he still continues. His jealousy of mankind, his jealousy of human beings, it still runs until today. He did not stop with Adam alayhi salam. Rather, he's continuing his jealousy. And his jealousy is leading him to create havoc and create corruption on earth through whispering to me and you and to everyone else. And sometimes we carry his invitations to create havoc amongst each other. So jealousy, indeed, it has that effect. It destroys and takes like effect on the outside. So shaitan's word himself, when he was jealous, he says, He said, خَلَقْتَنِي مِن نَارٍ وَخَلَقْتَهُ مِن طِينٍ. He created me out of fire, and he created him out of mud. How could that equal it to each other? So obviously, Shaitan is stupid as he made their own calculations in this regard. But nevertheless, this concept forced him to take action on the outside. One, the disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and two, the whispering to Adam and Eve. And thus, you know, we had to go through this whole issue of being outcasted from heaven, Adam having to, you know, put up with his kids and having to now cook for himself, grow for himself, do everything for himself, where before he was living like a king. So it does have effect on the outside. Let us take a short break and then we will continue our discussion. So don't go anywhere.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were saying that jealousy or hasad, in fact, has consequences on the outside that will infringe upon the right of other people. Sometimes it leads to killing other people, taking their essence, which is their life, away from this earth. Some people die and get killed because someone is jealous of them. And obviously, I don't need to give you examples of that. The Quran, however, does give us the best example of that hasad. Now, also going back in time, when we look at the Adam and his sons Habil and Qabil, so Allah asked them to give and offer the best they have to Allah as a qurban, as a sacrifice. So Qabil offered his and Habil offered his. Now the difference between Habil and Qabil, Qabil gave the worst of his sheep. Like he gave like the weak ones, the ones that are about to die, the ones that have no meat. It's like, okay, I don't need these ones, I can sacrifice them to Allah. While Habil gave the best that he had to Allah. So Allah in return, he accepted the sacrifice of Habil and rejected the sacrifice of Qabil. Now when Qabil saw that happens, or saw that happening, that Allah accepted his brother's gift and sacrifice but rejected his, he says to his brother plainly, قال لأقتلك, I am going to kill you, right? قال إنما يتقبل الله من المتقين, Allah surely accepts from the pious. لَئِن بَسَطَّ يَدِي لِتَقْتُلَنِي, even if you want to kill me, مَا أَنَا بِبَسَطٍ يَدِي إِلَيْكَ لَأَقْتُلَكَ, I would not do this to kill you. The idea here is that Qabil still, even with his brother speaking to him and being nice and kind to him, saying to him, look, you're still my brother, I'm not going to kill you, even if you want to kill me. But Qabil did not listen. فَطَوَّعَتْ لَهُ نَفْسَهُ قَتْلَ أَخِهِ فَقَتَلَهُ, and his nafs, his soul, it just whispered to him, said to him, no, you know what, just get rid of him. And he listened to his inner desires and his inner thoughts and his inner whatever it is that he had. And he killed his brother. فَقَتَلَهُ, this began, this qatl, this killing began because he started with jealousy. And that even began, even though it began with Adam's kids, Habil and Qabil, it still continues in the hearts of man. We still see people being killed, people's natural resources being deprived, people, gold and oil and what have you has been taken from them. Why? Because someone else is jealous that they have and I don't have it. And even wars, if you go to the Dark Ages, medieval ages, wars were raged against one another because of that notion of hasad. And sometimes, you know, even a person kills another person for what they have. So the issue of hasad does take effect on the outside that we need to be very aware of. Inshallah, we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.